Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Angel Insights, where we hear from some of the top performing business angels in the UK and the entrepreneurs behind some of their portfolio companies. I'm your host, Tom Britton, co-founder of Syndicate Room, creators of the Access EIS Fund, which uses data to identify some of the top performing angels in the UK and builds a fund that co-invests with these angels. But enough about me, let's get to the show. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Denzel Walters, who's a co-founder at Community Growth Ventures and an associate director of Optima Partners Compliance and Advisory. Prior to that, he spent time at CVC Credit Partners, and before that, 6 years at the Bank of England. Denzel, welcome to the show.
Tom, thanks for having me.
So as we always do, before we talk about you and your angel investing, I wanted to talk a bit about your professional career and then kind of build up to what led you to come into angel investing. I have to admit, you probably have one of the most ideal industry backgrounds for an angel investor. You've got experience as a financial analyst, a consultant, 6 years at the Bank of England, 2 years at a financial regulatory consultancy for asset management. Talk me through that. How did you get started in that industry? What got you interested in it?
So I was 17 years old. I was quite academic, so did quite well grades-wise in school. And I told my parents I didn't want to go to university, which was a bit hard to swallow at the time. If we kind of set the scene, this is 2012, general election, the Lib Dems have lied to the youth about tuition fees and now they've gone up to $9,000. But also my entire school career was in state schools, and I think state schools do a great job, but it didn't work for me per se. Right, it's hard to be in classes of 30. By the time I was about 16 or 17, I had real fatigue over school, fatigue over learning, fatigue over what I felt was really theoretical and nothing about real life. So at 17, I said, I want to go to work. I want to make some money and I want to learn something real. So my parents fell off their chair, got back up, said, what are you going to do? I was doing some revision in the library and I was telling the librarian, I'm not going to go to university. And she basically dusted off this old book full of apprenticeships that no one even knew was still there. So I started going through. The Bank of England was one that jumped out, went through that process. And then I think they recruited about 20 of us, maybe about 500, 600 applications or whatever. And then I started off there as an apprentice and then worked my way up. I was chomping at the bit, really hungry to learn, started picking up some basics in financial analysis. And I was like, this is cool. This relates to real life. And so I worked as an apprentice for a year, then worked as a junior researcher in the statistics division for a couple of years. Nice. And a lot of things are down to timing. So then what happened was after the great financial crisis, they split the FA into two, FCA and PRA. So joined the PRA, which is under the umbrella of the bank, and it allowed me to be really client facing.
Nice.
Right, it was really interesting. So you started talking to large banks, CEOs, CFOs, chairs of boards, looking at their financial stability and viability and how they continue to build up their balance sheets in line with regulation and also in line with the low interest rate environment post the crisis. So that's where I started cutting my teeth. Great place to learn so much information, right? You're at the center of the economy. And then after 6 years there, I was still aware that I wasn't quite getting the commercial experience that I wanted and needed.
Wanted and needed, though, to do what? Because you clearly have this plan in your mind.
Well, this is it. In the background, I've started angel investing. The Bank of England's great, but I'm attached to these large institutions. I started doing a bit of work in the new bank space. Mm-hmm. So I was, one, understanding the process for authorization and the hoops you have to go through as a firm, right? So the operational challenges you have to kind of overcome to be an authorized financial institution in the UK. I was understanding how they had to build their balance sheets, mm-hmm. understanding how to raise. So one of the key challenges at this stage was looking at the term sheets for early investors. And how did that fit within the regulatory regime, which was a real challenge that the bank was trying to adapt to. And so I was like, it's great being on this side. This has been really interesting. Now let me go to the other side, right? And understand how financial institutions are really doing this. So I thought the best way was to go to a consulting firm, which actually came calling. So Optima came calling. And by this time I'd built up some decent financial analytical skills. And so I came here to do the commercial application of regulation. What does it mean from an operation standpoint? What does it mean from a regulatory standpoint? What does it mean from senior managers in their decision-making, risk management structures, governance structures? How do they scale up and still kind of continue to meet those things? And it was also a small firm. So what I didn't want to be was another cog in a big machine, which I did at the bank, cut my teeth. So then I said, look, I'm interested in investing in early stage businesses. I need to understand some of these challenges a bit more intimately. This isn't quite early stage, right? It's 25 people and a couple offices, US and Singapore, but I've seen it go through the issues of scaling, hiring. How do we then manage 25 people, HR systems, policies, procedures, processes, and the development of those? There's practical things that you really have to do and get into to understand. So I want to do more than just my job at a firm. Obviously dealing with a lot of asset management clients as we do, and helping them with a commercial application and finding the resolutions, and then also internally helping the business grow. And then also sales. It was understanding that B2B sales cycle. How do these things really happen, move from the theory to the practical?
So basically everything that you would need to be a founder or a startup investor.
Well, yeah, in a safe environment.
In a safe environment.
Without giving up my paycheck or my job.
Amazing. Honestly, amazing. And I think it's incredible that a lot of people spend the 4 years at university trying to figure out what they want to do. You kind of had this plan and you talked about it a little bit, because when you were at the Bank of England, you were already thinking, I want to invest in startups. What was it about investing in startups that fascinated you the most? And then how did you more recently come to found Community Growth Ventures, which we'll talk about in a second?
So I was always interested in business and entrepreneurship from a really young age. I used to do paper rounds, used to wash cars. I used to buy things off of eBay and sell them to my friends. I used to sell sweets in school.
I did that too. Funny story about that. We used to have this thing called Raven's Revenge, which was like sugar, pure sugar, but flavored. And it came in these little vials that looked very much like drugs. And one day a teacher pulled me aside and said, what's in your pocket? And I was like, sugar. I had to produce these vials of flavored sugar and promise that it was actually sugar. Anyway, sorry.
But once again, I'd say what made it work for me was quickly identifying trends. That's actually what worked for me. So what happened was, when I joined secondary school in year 7, we had vending machines, loads of vending machines across the school. Then Jamie Oliver ruined every young person's dream. And vending machines were gone, unhealthy snacks were gone, chocolate, donuts, all gone. Right, it literally happened from year 7 to year 8. And so year 8, for me, there was a massive opportunity to start selling sweets in school.
Spotted a gap in the market.
Spotted a gap. Right, so I would take my lunch money, go to school. I don't know, it might be like $2.50 a day. Right, and I'd come home by the weekend and I'd have 80 quid. Yeah, just buy sweets every day. Buy sweets, go sell them. Buy sweets, go sell them.
Can we create a startup around this? Let's be honest, because that's an incredible IRR.
Well, this is it. I think it was frowned upon, and once it got found out, I had to stop. But yeah. But even some of the teachers, right? So teachers, teaching assistants, they wanted chocolate bars.
Did you make them pay more than the kids?
No. I should have. Propensity to pay, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think I always had like this entrepreneurial bug. Then I started working and I said, look, it's hard to do a business, but I'm still excited. And at 18, a lot of my friends went to university. It seemed like there was a lot of black and brown children at the time, my age, 18, 19, going in what was quite large swathes. I mean, proportionally still quite low, to top university. I remember being in a room with maybe like 100 black and brown kids. And they were all going to top universities, Russell Group universities. And so what I thought was, okay, well, there's a talent pipeline here. And there were so many ideas floating around the room. And so everyone was like, I want to do this business. I want to do that business. And all of this stuff. And I said, okay, well, I think I'm the only person in a full-time job at 18. Why don't I just start investing in some of them to make money? So I had no idea what angel investing was, no idea what venture capital was. I started at the bank and I was probably making about 16, 17 grand a year. But I'm at home at my parents' house, so I'm flush with cash. I'm absolutely flush. And I think I'm minted. And so I just start backing a couple of those opportunities, and that went very badly. But that was my first taste of angel investing.
I think Ross Singleton, when we had her on the show, was talking about never back friends or couples. Those always get you into trouble. So,
oh man.
Sounds like you were in a similar position.
Yeah. I learned a lot of harsh lessons really quickly. And I also understood that I knew very, very little about what I was doing. That I knew. That spoke to a lack of practical things that you learn in school. So no one taught you about business structures and how to really set up a business. No one taught you about investing. No one taught you about the legal side of investing. No one taught you about the process of all of these things. You don't learn in school at all. So 18, 19, 20, just trying to figure it out. And that's how I got into it.
Amazing. And fast forward a few years. So you've cut your teeth in business. You've got a better understanding of what it takes to be an angel. And now you've started your own syndicate. So tell me a little bit more about Community Growth Ventures, the thoughts behind it, and what you guys are focused on.
Yeah, so Community Growth Ventures is actually my second attempt at something similar. The first version was maybe 2013, 2014, after I've made a couple of completely catastrophic investments. I said, okay, but I do like this. And what I realized was that people had great ideas, but they needed the support around making it into a business. So I partnered with some really good friends of mine at Kamuzi, which is a digital agency, amazing business. And they've been running that for ages. So that's Alex, Akil, and Richard, amazing guys. And they were running their business like out of, I don't know what it was, some backstreet garage in Peckham. And we tried that for a year to provide them with services because they built their business from scratch. And they had to go and focus on the business. I had to go focus on my career. So I went away for a couple of years and then spent a lot of time just reading and learning. The Bank of England had a library, which is about two floors in the basement. And so I'm like, I've got this bug for this thing, but I still don't know what it is. And I come across venture capital. And so I start reading, start finding out about it, start thinking, okay, start to design what I think an idea of the future is and some early, very crappy theses and whatever else. And so I basically maybe made a business plan for CGV in about 2016. I finalized it. And then I said, no, I need to find a team. So I knew Emmanuel Aramu. He was someone I'd engaged with before, super cool guy. He'd been working in startups, doing a lot of marketing, growth hacking, the lot. So kind of, I went to him, I took him to the NED, which is opposite the bank, because I was trying to sell him this lifestyle, right? I was like, look, this is the life we can
live. Live at home. Know. No, you'd moved out by then.
Exactly. We came together, he had marketing experience, I had finance experience. We were looking each other in the eyes for about 2-3 weeks, nodding, saying, you're a genius. No, you're a genius. And I was like, this doesn't feel quite right. So we said, we need some balance. Because between both of us, we're going to think each other are geniuses and patting each other on the back all day. And that's not how we get to a good outcome.
It would just fail.
Yeah. I could see that very early. So we actually came across Abby Mohammed, who at the time background as a full stack engineer, had been delivering transformation projects for local councils across the UK, and recently done a kind of 6-month project at MOJ. And so had the tech experience. Came together and we said, look, I think there's a great talent, right, that's undiscovered for diverse founders. We're seeing an ecosystem already. And it's funny, we didn't have the data at this time, but we could see it. There are loads of these amazing founders that are struggling to get funding, right? We've got skills in these areas. And subsequently, we also onboarded Abigail, who I worked with at the Bank of England, who kind of operations, compliance, far stronger than I am. So we were the four co-founders with a wide range of skills that said, we want to be smart money. So let's invest in companies that we think are amazing, help them with the things that we've been doing for 10 years across our industries and that we know and have experience of, then also champion them in bringing other investors. That was kind of the genesis of CGV, Community Growth Ventures. And so we've, across 2018, 2019, 2020, maybe evaluated maybe 250 companies. We've closed 2 investments. Hopefully this month we'll close another 2. We're leading on the round for Black Bladder currently. And we said, look, we think we can pick amazing companies. And we've got founders that want us on the cap table, want our support, and they like the way that we work and operate. So then we said the next thing has to be to get larger tickets. So we're doing 10, 15K, 20K tickets, right? We've got these amazing companies. Well, let's get investors that are mission focused, that want to support and invest in diverse founders, but also, they're not here for charity, they're here for alpha, right? Yeah. They're here for financial returns, and we can fund these companies. So the deal that we're working on right now is probably the first time we've put in motion the syndicate. And so we've pulled in investors that are super interested in the deal that we presented, and we're looking to close a 100K syndicate on AngelList. And so we can say, look, we can pull this together. We've got 100K, investors are interested in our deal flow, and we'll just keep sharing that to make sure we get money into the right companies that otherwise wouldn't get funded.
Amazing. And there's a lot to pick apart there. I mean, first, like, you operate in a sense of you're not an accelerator, but you as the four founders all add the value and experience, if you will, of what someone might get through an accelerator program. So I take it you're quite active, the four of you in particular. Does that extend out to the other investors that you bring into the syndicate, or are they more passive?
I think it's a blend. Some are super interested in investing and want to invest. They like the opportunity and their mission focus. And then there's others who've got some real live and direct experience and so want to work with us to help these families in any shape where they can. So I think there's kind of a spectrum there. I guess some people are also trying to cut their teeth. Like, we've got a lot of new investors. It's the first time they've invested with us and the first time they've made an angel investment at all. And so they're kind of trying to cut their teeth and see how this works. It takes a while to understand that you've got super relevant experience that can help founders, because there's a bit of nervousness, a bit of shyness. And so that takes a while. But now we work with investors that they can help support and put resources and time into these founders to help them navigate issues and scale.
Fantastic. And secondly, and actually the more important issue, obviously CGV has a focus on supporting and backing underrepresented founders, right? And the term underrepresented is descriptive. You know, there's not a huge amount of founders from diverse backgrounds raising capital, often not getting covered in the news as much as counterparts who may not be from a more diverse background. There seems to be a break in the system somewhere. You said you spotted it earlier on, you know, when you were seeing this talent pool, but they weren't coming together and forming companies or raising capital. What's the biggest trend that you're seeing right now, or what's the biggest gap that you're seeing right now? Is there a trend to trying to correct that? And what more can we be doing to ensure that we don't have to use the title underrepresented in the future?
That is the aim. We're trying to solve an issue so that it's no longer an issue in the future. Absolutely right. At the point at which we get to, we no longer have to refer to founders as underrepresented or underestimated. We've achieved the mission that we set out to do. There's both sides of it, right? Treat it like a marketplace. So what do the investors need to do? What do the founders need to do? I think from the investors, if you're seriously interested, then firstly, go and invest. Secondly, don't be lazy. So I think investors, we're quite lazy. We look at pitch decks. We kind of spend 2-3 minutes. I think I saw something from, was it DocuSend? Or whatever, and it was like the average time spent on a pitch deck is like 2 minutes, right? So within 2 minutes, we're going to say yes or no. I think you do have to spend more time to go and find companies on time to understand their markets if they're not inherently quite close to you or something that you've got existing knowledge for. Like, you have to be put in the work. You can't be lazy about it and say, oh, we want to invest in diverse founders. We want to invest in women founders. And then not do anything about it and expect it to turn up to you. So we were quite active. We drew a line in the sand. We kind of, in our branding, in our messaging, in our resources, in our time, and in our investments, all show that we invest in underrepresented founders. I'm not saying anyone's portfolio has to be entirely underrepresented founders, but what we need is a rebalancing. And so as an investor, you have to be proactive about doing that and spending the time to do so. And then I think for the founders, one of them is messaging and positioning. There is a knowledge gap also of, okay, I've got this business, I've got this amazing opportunity. How do I package it in a way that I can help educate the investor about the amazing opportunity? Because that also is a skill. And when you're a diverse founder, especially if you're then trying to solve an issue that's either community focused or it's gender focused, you have to communicate it in a way that people can help close their knowledge gap and make them feel comfortable in this investment where they may not. Why we need more diverse investors also, I think there's two things. I think there's investor founder fit and there's investor market fit, right? And you, as a founder, you need to close the investor market fit so they can understand that market. Because a lot of the things that diverse founders are packaging, they're industries that are well understood. So if we think about femtech, if we think about e-commerce, they've decided to go into sectors that no one has ever invested or dabbled in before, but actually the specific issue that you're trying to solve for that end user, you need to close that gap. I think that's where diverse investors come in. Having the knowledge of that market already, whether through your personal experience or peer experience of those around you, and an empathy for the founder and the experience and journey that they're going through, and being able to understand that a lack of knowledge on something doesn't mean that you're not capable. It just means you don't know.
Fantastic advice for founders out there looking to raise. One other thing just to touch on there is obviously when you think of the stereotypical angel investor, you think of a white older male.
Yeah.
And there are definitely many more of them out there right now. So the third part of this audience is on the angel investor side and bringing new underrepresented angels into the foray. And clearly Community Growth Ventures are offering one channel for that. For anybody out there that's interested in angel investing, going to do a small plug here, sorry. Obviously check out your website, but as well, check out the UK Business Angel Association.
Yeah.
If you're looking to join an angel network that's more local to you, they've got a list of all of them in the different regions.
So I did a blog post recently about how to get into angel investing because I think loads of people just didn't realize how accessible it was.
Yeah.
Right? And I said, well, look, the first thing I did was I got myself on Crowdcube, Seeded, Syndicate Room when you guys were doing individual deals.
Okay.
And I would sit down, I'd go through the deals, I'd go through the discussions, I'd look at the deck, I'd do a bit of research. I made, I don't know, 10, 15 investments on there. But you can do tickets from £10 to whatever, right? And just do your research. I would do a 2-3 page memo, which I shared on an investment I did on there, Climate. Spoke to Duncan, the CEO, which I reached out to over Crowdcube. He made the time and I asked a series of questions and I said, this is a decent investment opportunity that I'd be happy to put down £250. And you can start learning the basics. Anyone can do that. Start there, right? Dip your toe in. I'd say spend the time, do the research. And it's like a skill, it's like a muscle. Anyone could be an angel investor.
Ask questions.
Oh, many. I always say, look, I'd rather be on this side of the table than that side of the table. Asking the questions is far easier than answering them, right?
Oh, fantastic. So let's talk then. You've done 15 of those investments and some outside of it, but let's talk about your approach to angel investing because you said writing a memo, which is very VC structured like. but no, I think if it works for you, definitely do it. I mean, I take notes, but putting it in the form of a memo, maybe I'll have to steal that from you. Let's change gears for a second. When you're looking at due diligence, you said you've looked at 250 companies with Community Growth Ventures. Given your background, do you generally get stuck doing the financial due diligence on the companies?
Oh, don't I always. So I used to build quite a few financial models in the bank. So I spend a lot of time ripping apart financial models. ripping apart financial models, looking at cash flow, looking at raises, looking at churn, CAC, LTV, their sustainability over a series of time, especially when you've depleted market channels and whatever. That's where I spend my time, unfortunately, when it gets to DD. What I'd say is because we invest at early stages, so we're looking at pre-seed and some seed. And realistically, what I always say to people is the financial model doesn't mean much. It's not really about the numbers on the page. It's more about the assumptions and your thinking around it. So have you got some form of a cost buffer? There could be some cost creep. When do you plan to raise your next round? And when do you plan to get that kickstarted? What milestones do you think you need to achieve for your next round? Customer acquisition, is that sustainable? So once you've exhausted viral marketing and every free channel possible, well, across a five-year model, do you expect the cost customer acquisition to go up? It's all these kind of things, right? When you're trying to understand the assumptions and the rationale behind what's on the page as opposed to the numbers on the page. So yeah, all of my time.
I think I'm going to tap into you for a masterclass on understanding financial models and startups. I think we should do it. We'll do it together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And I guess that goes to the strengths of your co-founders as well. You generally look at it from your lens of experience and perspective. Very cool. So let's talk now about two of the investments that you can share. So the first investment that you guys made was into, take us through it.
Afrocentric. Yeah. Incredible. Incredible. We don't invest if we're not this excited. I don't have enough superlatives. Where would I start? So the first thing I would say is that, and the most important thing is that Rachel and Joycel and the two co-founders are exceptional. I would put more money into them. And I just have to caveat everything with each angel investment I'm making has come from my wedding fund. So yeah, which is awful advice. Don't follow me. But every time I have to run it past my fiance.
Yeah.
So then you have to pass the team and then I have to run it past my fiance and say, by the way, I need to be running.
I think actually that's a good last step. Run it by your partner.
Yeah, absolutely.
If they get if they think it'll do well, you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. So Rachel and Joycelyn, his co-founders, were exceptional. They were like yin and yang, in perfect balance, knew their roles, clear division of labor. They were on this steep learning curve. They just kept on learning and getting better and adapting And so what it is, it's a hair care product for Afro hair, right? It's vegan and toxin free. We looked at it from a couple angles. As I speak to the market, I've talked about this investor founder fit and investor market fit. But first thing is first, founders were exceptional. There was no doubt in my mind. When we met them, we left the first meeting like, oh gosh, take our money. Just take our money. They were so keen to learn, were learning on the job and implementing everything they learned. They were coachable. They were resourceful. They were turning a penny into a pound because they'd struggled to fundraise. And they were doing about five-figure revenue. They were already stocked in Whole Foods. They had this community that was super engaged and loved the brand. And so they were spending nothing on marketing. And also, they'd really doubled down in the direct-to-consumer channel. So everything was data-driven. They had a data set on their customers they were utilizing to maximizing returns and incredible retention relative to e-commerce and consumer brands. What the challenge was when you're creating a product for Afro hair, they found it really hard to get funding because, as you said, with most of the angels and investors going to a white male, they didn't understand the problem.
They didn't have the investor product market fit.
Exactly. And so we saw it, and all I could think about was my mom has been making her own hair care products for the past 15, 20 years. Right? I've watched her in the kitchen on the Saturday using God knows what, all of these ingredients, right? Putting in the fridge and saying, don't eat. And those are hair products because the things that were stocked in the shelves were damaging people's hair and no one could find a scalable solution. They've been working on Afrocentrics since they were in university. So we met them, they'd been 7 years on the journey.
Wow.
Couldn't get funding, found a way to keep going, couldn't get funding. This is a multi-billion pound industry. Black women spend 6 times amount on hair care product and the hair than any other demographic. So we understood the market dynamics, the existing product on the shelves was really, really poor and damaging. We then have to understand the dynamic of what does hair mean to Black women? And if you type it into Google, hair is a core part of the Black women's identity. And these are things that we understood from two of our co-founders are Black women. So we understood that intimately. There's Black women in my family, my sister, my mom, my cousin. So I understood and saw this lived experience issue, right, on a regular weekly basis. And so we were like, we understand the market. We think that the founders are incredible. And then the product, people were raving about it. It was just about how do you make this bigger? And so they managed to continue and plow along for 7 years after university without any capital. And we were like, we need to get some money in this. So we brought together a bunch of angels. We raised a really small 60K round. And then they won the UK WeWork Creators Award.
Nice.
And came third in the global competition where they pitched to P. Diddy and Ashton Kutcher and whatever else and ended up raising £500,000. I think now everyone kind of knows who they are and how good they are. But at the time, they couldn't get funding and to us, it didn't make sense. And we said, like, if they can't get funding, no one can get funding. Exceptional founders, exceptional product with their own IP that they built in-house. And they were finding the most unique and resourceful ways to keep this business alive and growing without any external capital whatsoever.
And that's an incredible story and also kind of makes me sad that they couldn't get the funding earlier. And I know that's why Community Growth Ventures is established and you're looking at all these other investments now. I think it's great. Just from a returns perspective, obviously it's still on paper value, but I think it's public, their follow-on raises. And so from your initial investment, it's effectively on paper. It's doubled or more valuation.
Yeah, yeah. So they'll close their seed round and based on my calculations, 5X, 6X, just between pre-seed and seed. Because also, I think one of the things is because diverse founders are locked out of the funding system, what you kind of find out is that their businesses are actually probably relatively undervalued. And so what happens over time, and I think what happens over time is that should equalize because it becomes a great company and whatever, and then it equalizes because you can get investors in and now it lands to where it should be. Mm-hmm. But obviously, if you invest in an undervalued asset or stock, when it corrects, then you make great returns. And we don't even think it's fully corrected yet, right? It might do it Series A. So I think on our investments, currently 5X.
Amazing. Side question about that, though. So obviously you're there to support the underrepresented founders and you've spotted this potential for alpha. Does that play in your mind, though, when you're talking about valuation? Because you know that they've struggled to raise capital. You know that they're probably lower than the valuation that they should be at, and you're being offered to get in on that valuation. Do you just take it, or do you ever go back and say, look, you should take it at a higher valuation?
Yeah, we have the conversation. I think you need to manage dilution, right? So we have it more from a dilutions perspective. Like, look, you need to manage dilution, how much equity you're giving up here. So it's either do you need to raise this much, or can you increase the valuation because this is where it should be? Because we're not ever trying to decentralize founders over a long term. Also for us, we're not playing ownership play. We're playing a multiples play, right? That's our angle. So we're going for, can we get multiples on our investment? Because we're investing 10, 15, 20 Ks, right? At such an early stage that it's a multiple play. We haven't got a £1 billion fund that we need to return 3X on. And now you need to earn some serious equity and some winners.
You want life-changing return, not car-changing return.
Exactly. We try and be entirely transparent and share everything that we know and have those conversations about every aspect of the business. And you want to ensure that founders are incentivized for a long time. You only get to like a Series A, B, and like, oh gosh, I own 10% of my business.
No, I think that's right. And when you talk to, I hate to say the good angels, but they always keep that in their mind. Like, you know, if I take this much at this stage and at the next round, someone else comes in and takes 20 in the next round, someone else takes 20, then the founders are going to have, they're not going to want to do it later on. So no, it's good to hear you saying that. I want to talk about the second company then you invested in. So Freda, take us through that one.
Yeah, Freda. So we met Daniel Lawrence at Tech Hub, which is now closed. They were really great. We had a good relationship with them.
We started at Tech Hub, or our London presence was Tech Hub over by Old Street. So some good days spent there.
Yeah, RIP Tech Hub. They were really good. And we met Daniel Lawrence there, and we kind of met maybe about 5-6 companies in a day. They kind of said, look, we've got some unrepresented founders, come down. We were like, okay, we came down. So I had to take like a half day off of work and whatever. And the team went down there and we came across Daniel Lawrence and we were like, what? Like, well, she needs to be funded. It would shame again, right? And so Freda automates the processing of information from documents. And there's kind of a lot of manual processing in the middle and back office of financial institutions. I've seen it myself at the Bank of England. Danielle had seen it at a time in Goldman's and a couple of mid-tier PE firms that she'd worked at. So she kind of really understands the issue. Me and Abigail understand the issue with our financial experience and institution background. And so that one was kind of understand the issue. She was building what was a really awesome product, leveraging machine learning and AI to then do that automated processing of information. It was one of those ones like why does this not exist yet? And that's a great question. Those are some of those investments you want to make.
So long as the response isn't, it actually does. You get so many founders coming in that are like, we're the only ones that do this. And then you Google it and you're like, no.
Like, did you look at Google, the first page?
Yeah.
So we just thought, great founder, understood the market really well. She has kind of navigated the issue because she's not a technical founder. So she had got a super experienced CTO on as a co-founder who'd been building a tech solutions for large financial institutions. And she also did a really cool partnership with the University of Exeter, which they basically offered like professors and lecturers that could help her build out the product because they wanted to get
the data.
No, not the data. They wanted to get them commercial experience. They said, we've got all of these people, but they need commercial experience. And so she managed to onboard some of them to really build out the tech.
Nice.
And then me and Abigail work in and around asset management. And so a lot of the companies you're targeting, we could kind of make warm intros to or introductions or get you in these spaces and whatever else. So great founder, in-house tech, which I think is really, really key for IP, for understanding. And she'd also won some grants from Innovate UK, which she was using, plus her own capital to finance the growth of the business. So hers wasn't so much the challenge that she couldn't raise, right? She raised some Innovate UK. She had some angels. We had a really good relationship with her, helped her out with some key aspects of B2B sales and whatever else. And this is maybe like a year before we've invested. So we're having ongoing conversations and dialogue, help them navigate a couple of things when COVID bit and thinking about strategy around that. And then she was just saying, look, I think you're really great founders. You kind of understand me, supported me before you put any money in, put a lot of time in. I'd love you on our cap table. So this was a diverse founder who was building an exceptional company, and it ticks all of the typical VC investable businesses, fintech tick, B2B tick, obvious MRR and ARR. And she wanted us on the cap table. And for us, it was kind of like, okay, we're doing something right. These companies want us on the cap table. We're doing something right. And they understand and recognize our value and the support that we can provide, whether we're investing or not. I mean, I'm excited about every investment we make, right? So I'm obviously very biased. I'm very biased, but I'm super excited for Freda. Super, super excited for Freda.
Fantastic. And you mentioned it a little bit, but it's pay it forward a little bit. I hate to use that phrase because it's kind of cliche, but the angels and groups, including yourselves, who are out there, who want to make a difference in the industry, who are helping people without expecting anything back, you get a good reputation and then it comes back. You know, you put in some time with her, you show that you can add value, and then she could probably pick from a number of different groups to invest. And she went with you because she knew you would continue to add value. And I mean, you talked about multiples, but you're not doing it just for that.
No, not at all. What we found is that there's a couple of deals that we're in on where founders have moved minimum ticket sizes, right? So they said, like, look, minimum ticket size is 50K, right? This is what it is. And we said, we don't have 50K, right? We're doing 10, 15K, 20K tickets. And like, okay, well, let's change the ticket size because we want you on the cap table.
Nice.
And for us, that was validation that we're doing something that has purpose and can make a difference. I think as an investor, the biggest compliment you can have is founders wanting you on the cap table.
Yeah, you can't get any better than that.
Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Oh, fantastic. So you've been investing for a while. You talked about getting it wrong early on.
Yeah.
Let's dive into a lesson learned from that experience and from your first 2.5 years with CGV.
Get your legals in order. Don't skip due diligence, right? I think those are kind of the biggest thing. So I'd say get your legals in order. The first investment I made at 18, 19, I was very naive and handed over some money, and then the company didn't even spend the money correctly. And then there was just, I don't know what happened. What I also knew is I didn't have any legal rights whatsoever. So that was that one. And also doing due diligence. If you're doing it through CrowdCube Studios, you obviously might not have access to a data room, but spend some time where you can.
Write a memo.
Just get your thoughts out. My team kind of think it's the Bank of England. It's like a very academic institution. So the first memo I wrote was like 10 to 12 pages. And my team were like, yeah, no one's going to read this, including us. So condense it to about 2 or 3 pages. But I think it's just useful to articulate your thoughts and why you think something is a good investment. Always understand what you think the key challenges are, barriers to scale, barriers to getting to the next round, and where you can help, and understand where you can add value and where you can help.
So I've got a few quick fire questions then to kind of wrap up the show, because you've been very generous with your time. You mentioned previously had access to 2 floors of library. What would you say was the best book that you've read recently, business or non-business? Doesn't matter.
I was listening to an Audible the other day. I think it was Peter Lynch, Learn to Earn. And I've actually got some quite extensive notes on it. It's quite a simple book, but it's just on the basics of making money through public stock investing. And I think that some of that is actually really quite useful for early stage investing. Essentially, you're investing in companies that you believe one day should be able to pay a dividend. And if they can't pay a form of a dividend in the future, at some point you don't believe that, you probably shouldn't be investing.
Seems sensible. Number 2, what's the tech trend that you're most interested in this year?
Yeah, okay. So I'm super bullish on big data, and that's one of the companies that are working on big data companies. I'm super geeked out about. So I spent a bit of time on data in the bank. So that one, super, super excited for Femtech, because firstly, I think Femtech as a name needs to be abolished. We're talking about half of the population. But I'm super excited for some of the things that I'm seeing come through on female health issues. And I've got like a better insight. So with my fiance, we have these discussions all the time. And so I've got much more of an insight. And all the time I'm like, but why is this not a solution right now? Like, why is this not in boots? Why is this not whatever? So super, super bullish on that. And then I'm super excited about the continuing growth in tech infrastructure for small to medium businesses and as everything comes into as a service.
So you've been investing now for 8-ish years, going on 9 years. What is it that you find most rewarding after all this time investing and working with startups?
Talking to incredible founders that are super passionate about what they're doing, super focused on what they're doing. And passion comes out in different ways. Some people are excitable, like myself. Some people are less excitable, but like super detail-oriented or whatever. But just working with founders that are passionate in whichever ways that come out about what they're doing, because that's super infectious. That's what we're here for. Like, and learning. I think the amount of things that you learn about, things I've never sat down and read about, as you talk to different founders across different sectors and verticals, is amazing.
Fantastic. Last question. You mentioned get your legals in order, do your due diligence. But if you could go back in time and talk to yourself when you were just starting this out, what's one key thing that you would have liked to have known when you started?
What the hell angel investing is? One of the key things I'd have liked to have learned, make yourself a little process, right? That took me a while. So I was like, oh, that's exciting when you put some money in. Oh, that's exciting when you put some money in. And it took me a while to formulate a process. And it's like a mental model. It's not like hard deadlines and rules, but it's just a guiding mental model and frameworks about how you look at businesses, which has got to be open to new information. Also trust your gut, because there's a couple where it doesn't quite fit a mental model. So that's where I'm at now, right? It doesn't quite fit the mental model. And I've got this gut instinct, but I can't get it into the mental model. So getting that balance, it's an art and a science, and it's the balance of both.
Two for the price of one with that. Two bits of fantastic advice.
Yeah.
It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing, for being so open with things. Give yourself a quick plug in your business and we'll leave it there.
No, co-founder of Community Growth Ventures, invest in diverse and underrepresented founders. You can find us at www.communitygrowth.ventures, on Twitter at CGVHQ, and myself at DenzelCGV on Twitter.
Fantastic. You know what? Have a great day. We will speak again soon, I hope. We'll revisit this in 6 months' time, 12 months' time, and see how things are going.
And you too, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.
All right. Bye.
You've been listening to Angel Insights, produced by Syndicate Room. Until next time, bye.